Side 4.
Arthur started with horror and fear, first at what he appeared to have done, and then at the loud sirens and bells that suddenly shattered the air to announce some clamouring emergency. He stared wildly around him. The only exit appeared to be the way he had come in. He pelted toward it, throwing away the nasty fake leopard skin bag as he did so. He dashed randomly, haphazardly through the labyrinthine maze. He seemed to be pursued more and more fiercely by klaxons, sirens, flashing lights. Suddenly he turned a corner, and there was a light in front of him. It wasn't flashing. It was daylight. Chapter 19. Although it has been said that on Earth alone in our galaxy is cricket treated as a fit subject for a game, and that for this reason the Earth has been shunned, this only applies to our galaxy, and more specifically to our dimension. In some of the higher dimensions, they feel they can more or less please themselves, and they have been playing a peculiar game called Brockian Ultra Cricket for whatever their transdimensional equivalent of billions of years is. Let's be blunt, it's a nasty game, says the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but then anyone who's been to any of the higher dimensions will know that they're a pretty nasty heathen lot up there who should just be smashed and done in, and would be too if anyone could work out a way of firing missiles at right angles to reality. This is another example of the fact that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy will employ anybody who wants to walk straight in off the street and get ripped off, especially if they happen to walk in off the street during the afternoon when very few of the regular staff members are there. There is a fundamental point here. The history of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is one of idealism, struggle, despair, passion, success, failure, and enormously long lunch breaks. The earliest origins of the guide are now, along with most of its financial records, lost in the mists of time. For other and more curious theories about where they are lost, see below. Most of the surviving stories, however, speak of a founding editor called Herling Frutmig. Herling Frutmig, it is said, founded the guide, established its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism, and went bust. There followed many years of penury and heart-searching, during which he consulted friends, sat in darkened rooms in illegal states of mind, thought about this and that, fooled about with weights, and then, after a chance encounter with the holy lunching friars of Vundun, who claimed that just as lunch was at the centre of a man's temporal day, and man's temporal day could be seen as an analogy for his spiritual life, so lunch should be A, seen as the centre of man's spiritual life, and B, held in jolly nice restaurants, he refounded the guide, laid down its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism and where you could stuff them both, and led the guide on to its first major commercial success. He also started to develop and explore the role of the editorial lunch break that was subsequently to play such a crucial part in the guide's history, since it meant that most of the actual work got done by any passing stranger who happened to wander into the empty offices of an afternoon and saw something worth doing. Shortly after this, the guide was taken over by Mega Dodo Publications of Ursa Minor Beta, thus putting the whole thing on a very sound financial footing, and allowing the fourth editor, Lig Lurie Jr., to embark on lunch breaks of such breathtaking scope that even the efforts of recent editors, who started undertaking sponsored lunch breaks for charity, seem like mere sandwiches in comparison. In fact, Lig never formally resigned his editorship. He merely left his office late one morning and has never since returned. Though well over a century has now passed, many members of the guide staff still retain the romantic notion that he has simply popped out for a ham croissant and will yet return to put in a solid afternoon's work. Strictly speaking, all editors since Lig Lurie Jr. have therefore been designated acting editors, and Lig's desk is still preserved the way he left it, with the addition of a small sign that says, Lig Lurie Jr., editor, missing, presumed fed. Some very scurrilous and subversive sources hint at the idea that Lig actually perished in the guide's first extraordinary experiments in alternative bookkeeping. Very little is known of this, and still less said. Anyone who even notices, let alone calls attention to the curious but utterly coincidental and meaningless fact that every world on which the guide has ever set up an accounting department has shortly afterwards perished in warfare or some natural disaster, is liable to get sued to smithereens. It is an interesting, though utterly unrelated, fact that the 2 or 3 days prior to the demolition of the planet Earth to make way for a new hyperspace bypass saw a dramatic upsurge in the number of UFO sightings there, not only above Lord's Cricket Ground and St. John's Wood, London, but also above Glastonbury and Somerset. Glastonbury had long been associated with myths of ancient kings, witchcraft, and wart-curing, and had now been selected as the site of the guide's new financial records office, and indeed 10 years' worth of financial records were transferred to a magic hill just outside the city, mere hours before the Vogons arrived. None of these facts, however strange or inexplicable, is as strange or inexplicable as the rules of the game of Brockian ultra-cricket, as played in the higher dimensions. A full set of rules is so massively complicated that the only time they were all bound together in a single volume, they underwent gravitational collapse and became a black hole. A brief summary, however, follows. Rule 1. Grow at least 3 extra legs. You won't need them, but it keeps the crowds amused. Rule 2. Find 1 extremely good Brockian ultra cricket player. Clone him off a few times. This saves an enormous amount of tedious selection and training. Rule 3. Put your team and the opposing team in a large field and build a high wall around them. The reason for this is that though the game is a major spectator sport, the frustration experienced by the audience at not actually being able to see what's going on leads them to imagine that it's a lot more exciting than it really is. A crowd that has just watched a rather humdrum game experiences far less life affirmation than a crowd that believes it has just missed the most dramatic event in sporting history. Rule 4. Throw lots of assorted items of sporting equipment over the wall for the players. Anything will do. Cricket bats, base cube bats, tennis guns, skis, anything you can get a good swing with. Rule 5. The players should now lay about themselves for all their worth with whatever they find to hand. Whenever a player scores a hit on another player, he should immediately run away as fast as he can and apologise from a safe distance. Apologies should be concise, sincere, and for maximum clarity and points, delivered through a megaphone. Rule 6. The winning team shall be the first team that wins. Curiously enough, the more the obsession with the game grows in the higher dimensions, the less it is actually played, since most of the competing teams are now in a state of permanent warfare with each other over the interpretation of these rules. This is all for the best, because in the long run, a good solid war is less psychologically damaging than a protracted game of Brockian ultra cricket. Chapter 20. As Arthur ran, darting, dashing, and panting down the side of the mountain, he suddenly felt the whole bulk of the mountain move very, very slightly beneath him. There was a rumble, a roar, and a slight blurred movement, and a lick of heat in the distance behind and above him. He ran in a frenzy of fear. The land began to slide, and he suddenly felt the force of the word landslide in a way that had never been apparent to him before. It had always just been a word to him, but now he was suddenly and horribly aware that sliding is a strange and sickening thing for land to do. It was doing it with him on it. He felt ill with fear and trembling. The ground slid, the mountain slurred. He slipped, he fell, he stood, he slipped again and ran. The avalanche began. Stones, then rocks, then boulders pranced past him like clumsy puppies, only much bigger, much, much harder and heavier, and almost infinitely more likely to kill you if they fell on you. His eyes danced with them, his feet danced with the dancing ground, he ran as if running were a terrible sweating sickness, his heart pounded to the rhythm of the pounding geological frenzy around him. The logic of the situation, i.e. that he was clearly bound to survive if the next foreshadowed incident in the saga of his inadvertent persecution of Agrajag was to happen, was utterly failing to impinge itself on his mind or exercise any restraining influence on him at this time. He ran with the fear of death in him, under him, over him, and grabbing hold of his hair. And suddenly he tripped again and was hurled forward by his considerable momentum. But just at the moment he was about to hit the ground astoundingly hard, he saw lying directly in front of him a small navy blue holdall that he knew for a fact he had lost in the baggage retrieval system at Athens Airport some 10 years previously in his personal timescale, and in his astonishment he missed the ground completely and bobbed off into the air with his brain singing. What he was doing was this. He was flying. Glanced around him in surprise, but there could be no doubt that that was what he was doing. No part of him was touching the ground, and no part of him was even approaching it. He was simply floating there with boulders hurtling through the air around him. He could now do something about that, blinking with the non-effort of it. He wafted higher into the air, and now the boulders were hurtling through the air beneath him. He looked downward with intense curiosity, Between him and the shivering ground were now some 30 feet of empty air. Empty, that is, if you discounted the boulders that didn't stay in it for long, but bounded on downward in the iron grip of the law of gravity. The same law that seemed all of a sudden to have given Arthur a sabbatical. It occurred to him almost instantly, with the instinctive correctness that self-preservation instills in the mind, that he mustn't try to think about it, that if he did, the law of gravity would suddenly glance sharply in his direction and demand to know what the hell he thought he was doing up there, and all would suddenly be lost. So he thought about tulips. It was difficult, but he did. He thought about the pleasing firm roundness of the bottom of tulips. He thought about the interesting variety of colours they came in, and wondered what proportion of the total number of tulips that grew or had grown on the earth would be found within a radius of 1 mile from a windmill. After a while, he got dangerously bored of this train of thought. Felt the air slipping away beneath him, felt that he was drifting down into the paths of the bouncing boulders that he was trying so hard not to think about. So he thought about Athens Airport for a bit, and that kept him usefully annoyed for about 5 minutes, at the end of which he was startled to discover that he was now floating about 600 feet above the ground. He wondered for a moment how he was going to get back down to it, but instantly shied away from that area of speculation again and tried to look at the situation steadily. He was flying. What was he going to do about it? He looked back down at the ground. He didn't look at it hard, but did his best just to give it an idle glance, as it were, in passing. There were a couple of things he couldn't help noticing. One was that the eruption of the mountain seemed now to have spent itself. There was a crater just a little way beneath the peak, presumably where the rock had caved in on top of the huge, cavernous cathedral, the statue of himself and the sadly abused figure of Agrajag. The other was his holdall. The one he'd lost at Athens Airport. It was sitting pertly on a piece of clear ground, surrounded by exhausted boulders, but apparently hit by none of them. Why this should be, he could not speculate, but since this mystery was completely overshadowed by the monstrous impossibility of the bags being there in the first place, it was not a speculation he really felt strong enough for anyway. The thing is, it was there, and the nasty fake leopardskin bag seemed to have disappeared, which was all to the good, if not entirely to the explicable. He was faced with the fact that he was going to have to pick the thing up. Here he was, flying along 600 feet above the surface of an alien planet, the name of which he couldn't even remember. He could not ignore the plaintive posture of this tiny piece of what used to be his life, here, so many light years from the pulverized remains of his home. Furthermore, he realized the bag, if it was still in the same state in which he'd lost it, would contain a can that would have in it the only Greek olive oil still surviving in the universe. Slowly, carefully, inch by inch, he began to bob downward, swinging gently from side to side like a nervous sheet of paper, feeling its way toward the ground. It went well. He was feeling good. The air supported him but let him through. 2 minutes later, he was hovering a mere 2 feet above the bag and was faced with some difficult decisions. He bobbed there lightly. He frowned, but again as lightly as he could. If he picked the bag up, could he carry it? Wouldn't the extra weight pull him straight to the ground? Wouldn't the mere act of touching something on the ground suddenly discharge whatever mysterious force it was that was holding him in the air? Wouldn't he be better off just being sensible at this point and stepping out of the air back onto the ground for a moment or two? If he did, would he ever be able to fly again? The sensation when he allowed himself to be aware of it was so quietly ecstatic that he could not bear the thought of losing it, perhaps forever. With this in mind, he bobbed upward a little, just to try the feel of it, the surprise and effortless movement of it. He bobbed, he floated, he tried a little swoop. The swoop was terrific. With his arms spread out in front of him, his hair and his dressing gown streaming out behind him, he dived down out of the sky, bellied along a body of air about 2 feet from the ground, and swung back up again, catching himself at the top of the swing and holding, just holding. He stayed there. It was wonderful. And that, he realized, was the way to pick up the bag. He would swoop down and catch hold of it just at the moment of the upswing. He would carry it on up with him. He might wobble a bit, but he was certain that he could hold it. He tried one or two more practice swoops, and they got better and better. The air on his face, the bounce and woof of his body, all combined to make him feel an intoxication of the spirit that he hadn't felt as far as he could work out, since he was born. He drifted away on the breeze and surveyed the countryside, which was, he discovered, pretty nasty. It had a wasted, ravaged look. He decided not to look at it anymore. He would just pick up the bag and then... He didn't know what he was going to do after he picked up the bag. He decided he would just pick up the bag and see where things went from there. He judged himself against the wind, pushed up against it, and turned around. He floated on its body. He didn't realise it, but his body was Williaming at this point. He ducked down under the airstream, dipped, and dived. The air threw itself past him. He thrilled through it. The ground wobbled uncertainly, straightened its ideas out, and rose smoothly up to meet him, offering the bag, its cracked plastic handles up towards him. Halfway down, there was a sudden dangerous moment when he could no longer believe he was doing this, and therefore very nearly wasn't. But he recovered himself in time, skimmed over the ground, slipped an arm smoothly through the handles of the bag, and began to climb back up again. Couldn't make it, and all of a sudden collapsed, bruised, scratched, and shaking on the stony ground. He staggered instantly to his feet, swayed hopelessly around, swinging the bag around him in an agony of grief and disappointment. His feet suddenly were stuck heavily to the ground in the way they always had been. His body seemed like an unwieldy sack of potatoes that reeled, stumbling against the ground. His mind had all the lightness of a bag of lead. He sagged and swayed and ached with giddiness. He tried hopelessly to run, but his legs were suddenly too weak. He tripped and flopped forward. At that moment, he remembered that in the bag he was now carrying was not only a can of Greek olive oil, but a duty-free allowance of Retsina. And in the pleasurable shock of that realization, he failed to notice for at least 10 seconds that he was now flying again. He whooped and cried with relief and pleasure and sheer physical delight. He swooped, he wheeled, he skidded and whirled through the air. Cheekily, he sat on an updraft and went through the contents of the holdall. He felt the way he imagined an angel must feel doing its celebrated dance on the head of a pin while being counted by philosophers. He laughed with pleasure at the discovery that the bag did in fact contain the olive oil and the Retsina, as well as a pair of cracked sunglasses, some sand-filled swimming trunks, some creased postcards of Santorini, a large and unsightly towel, some interesting stones, and various scraps of paper with the addresses of people he was relieved to think he would never meet again, even if the reason why was a sad one. He dropped the stones, put on the sunglasses, and let the pieces of paper whip away in the wind. 10 minutes later, drifting idly through a cloud, he got a large and extremely disreputable cocktail party in the small of the back. Chapter 21. The longest and most destructive party ever held is now into its fourth generation, and still no one shows any signs of leaving. Someone did once look at his watch, but that was 11 years ago now, and there has been no follow-up. The mess is extraordinary and has to be seen to be believed, but if you don't have any particular need to believe it, then don't go and look because you won't enjoy it. There have recently been some bangs and flashes up in the clouds, and there is one theory that this is a battle being fought between the fleets of several rival carpet cleaning companies who are hovering over the thing like vultures. But you shouldn't believe anything you hear at parties, and particularly not anything you hear at this one. One of the problems, and it's one that's obviously going to get worse, is that all the people at the party are either the children or the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren of the people who wouldn't leave in the first place. And because of all the business about selective breeding and recessive genes and so on, it means that all the people now at the party are either absolutely fanatical partygoers or gibbering idiots, or more and more frequently, both. Either way, it means that genetically speaking, each succeeding generation is now less likely to leave than the preceding one. So other factors come into operation, like when the drinks are going to run out. Now, because of certain things that have happened that seemed like a good idea at the time, and one of the problems of the party that never stops, is that all the things that only seem like a good idea at parties continue to seem like good ideas, that point seems still to be a long way off. One of the things that seemed like a good idea at the time was that the party should fly. Not in the normal sense that parties are meant to fly, but literally. One night, long ago, a band of drunken astro-engineers of the first generation clambered around the building, digging this, fixing that, banging very hard on the other, and when the sun rose the following morning, it was startled to find itself shining on a building full of happy, drunken people that was now floating like a young and uncertain bird over the treetops. Not only that, but the flying party had also managed to arm itself rather heavily. If they were going to get involved in any petty arguments with wine merchants, they wanted to make sure they had might on their side. The transition from full-time cocktail party to part-time raiding party came with ease, and did much to add that extra bit of zest and swing to the whole affair that was badly needed at this point because of the enormous number of times that the band had already played all the numbers it knew over the years. They looted, they raided, they held whole cities to ransom for fresh supplies of cheese crackers, guacamole, spare ribs, and wine and spirits that would now get piped aboard from floating tankers. The problem of when the drinks are going to run out is, however, going to have to be faced one day. The planet over which they are floating is no longer the planet it was when they first started floating over it. It is in bad shape. The party has attacked and raided an awful lot of it, and no one has ever succeeded in hitting it back because of the erratic and unpredictable way in which it lurches around the sky. It is one hell of a party. It is also one hell of a thing to get hit by in the small of the back. Chapter 22. Arthur lay floundering in pain on a piece of ripped and dismembered reinforced concrete, flicked at by wisps of passing cloud, and confused by the sounds of flabby merrymaking somewhere indistinctly behind him. There was a sound he couldn't immediately identify, partly because he didn't know the tune I Left My Leg in Jaglan Beta, and partly because the band playing it was very tired, and some members of it were playing in 3/4 time, some in 4/4, and some in a kind of pi-eyed pi-r squared, each according to the amount of sleep he'd managed to grab recently. He lay panting heavily in the wet air and tried feeling bits of himself to see where he might be hurt. Wherever he touched himself, he encountered a pain. After a short while, he worked out that this was because it was his hand that was hurting. He seemed to have sprained his wrist. His back, too, was hurting, but he soon satisfied himself that he was not badly hurt, but just bruised and a little shaken, as who wouldn't be. He couldn't understand what a building would be doing flying through the clouds. On the other hand, he would have been a little hard-pressed to come up with any convincing explanation of his own presence, so he decided that he and the building were just going to have to accept each other. He looked up from where he was lying. A wall of pale but stained stone slabs rose up behind him, the building proper. He seemed to be stretched out on some sort of ledge or lip that extended outward for about 3 or 4 feet all the way around. It was a hunk of the ground in which the party building had had its foundations, and which it had taken along with itself to keep itself bound together at the bottom end. Nervously he stood up, and suddenly, looking out over the edge, he felt nauseous with vertigo. He pressed himself back against the wall, wet with mist and sweat. His head was swimming freestyle, but his stomach was doing the butterfly. Even though he had got up here under his own power, he could now not even bear to contemplate the hideous drop in front of him. He was not about to try his luck jumping. He was not about to move an inch closer to the edge. Clutching his holdall, he edged along the wall, hoping to find a doorway in. The solid weight of the can of olive oil was a great reassurance to him. He was edging in the direction of the nearest corner, in the hope that the wall around the corner might offer more in the way of entrances than this one, which offered none. The unsteadiness of the building's flight made him feel sick with fear, and after a short time he took the towel from out of his bag and did something with it which once again justified its supreme position in the list of useful things to take with you when you hitchhike round the galaxy. He put it over his head so he wouldn't have to see what he was doing. His feet edged along the ground. His outstretched hand edged along the wall. Finally he came to the corner, and as his hand rounded the corner, it encountered something that gave him such a shock he nearly fell off. It was another hand. The two hands gripped each other. He desperately wanted to use his other hand to pull the towel away from his eyes, but it was holding the bag with the olive oil, the retzina, and the postcards of Santorini, and he very much didn't want to put it down. He experienced one of those self moments, one of those moments when you suddenly turn around and look at yourself and think, "Who am I? What am I up to? What have I achieved? Am I doing well?" He whimpered very slightly. He tried to free his hand, but he couldn't. The other hand was holding his tightly. He had no recourse but to edge onward toward the corner. He leaned around it and shook his head in an attempt to dislodge the towel. This seemed to provoke a sharp cry of some unfathomable emotion from the owner of the other hand. The towel was whipped from his head, and he found his eyes peering into those of Ford Prefect. Beyond him stood Slaty Bartfast, and beyond them he could clearly see a porchway and a large closed door. They were both pressed back against the wall, eyes wild with terror, as they stared out into the thick, blind cloud around them and tried to resist the lurching and swaying of the building. "Where the zarking photon have you been?" hissed Ford, panic-stricken. "Well," stuttered Arthur, not really knowing how to sum it all up that briefly. "Here and there. What are you doing here?" Ford turned his wild eyes on Arthur again. "They won't let us in without a bottle," he hissed. The first thing Arthur noticed as they entered into the thick of the party, apart from the noise, the suffocating heat, the wild profusion of colours that protruded dimly through the atmosphere of heady smoke, the carpets thick with ground glass, ash and guacamole droppings, and the small group of pterodactyl-like creatures and lurex who descended on his cherished bottle of Retsina, squawking, "A new pleasure! A new pleasure!" was Trillian being chattered up by a thunder god. "Didn't I see you at Milliway's?" he was saying. "Were you the one with the hammer?" "Yes, I much prefer it here, so much less reputable, so much more fraught." Squeals of some hideous pleasure ran around the room, the outer dimensions of which were invisible through the heaving throng of happy, noisy creatures, cheerfully yelling things that nobody could hear at each other, and occasionally having crises. "Seems fun," said Trillian. "What did you say, Arthur?" "I said, how the hell did you get here?" "I was a row of dots flowing randomly through the universe. Have you met Thor? He makes thunder." "Hello," said Arthur. I expect that must be very interesting."
"Hi," said Thor. "It is. Have you got a drink?"
No, actually."
"Then why don't you go and get one?"
"See you later, Arthur," said Trillian.
Something jogged Arthur's mind, and he looked round huntedly.
"Safeford isn't here, is he?"
"See you," said Trillian firmly, "later."
Thor glared at him with hard, coal-black eyes, his beard bristling. What little light there was in the place mustered its forces briefly to glint menacingly off the horns on his helmet. He took Trillian's elbow in his extremely large hand, and the muscles in his upper arm moved around each other like a couple of Volkswagens parking. He led her away. "One of the interesting things about being immortal," he said, "is one of the interesting things about space," Arthur heard Slarty Bartfast saying to a large and voluminous creature who looked like someone losing a fight with a pink duvet and was gazing raptly at the old man's deep eyes and silver beard, "is how dull it is."
"Dull?" said the creature, and blinked her rather wrinkled and bloodshot eyes.
"Yes," said Slarty Bartfast, "staggeringly dull, bewilderingly so. You see, there's so much of it and so little in it. Would you like me to quote you some of the statistics?"
Well, please, I would like to. They, too, are quite sensationally dull."
"I'll come back and hear them in a moment," she said, patted him on the arm, lifted up her skirts like a hovercraft, and moved off into the heaving crowd.
"I thought you'd never go," growled the old man. "Come, Earthman."
"Arthur, we must find the silver bale. It is here somewhere."
"Can't we just relax a little?" Arthur said. "I've had a tough day. Trillian's here, incidentally. She didn't say how. It probably doesn't matter."
"Think of the danger to the universe."
"The universe," said Arthur, "is big enough and old enough to look after itself for half an hour."
"Oh, right," he added in response to Slarty Bartfast's increasing agitation. "I'll wander around and see if anybody's seen it."
"Good, good," said Slarty Bartfast. "Good." He plunged into the crowd himself and was told to relax by everybody he passed.
"Have you seen a bale anywhere?" said Arthur to a little man who seemed to be standing eagerly waiting to listen to somebody. It's made of silver, vitally important for the future safety of the universe, and about this long."
"No," said the enthusiastically wizened little man, but do have a drink and tell me all about it."
Ford Prefect writhed past, dancing a wild, frenetic, and not entirely unobscene dance with someone who looked as if she was wearing Sydney Opera House on her head. He was yelling a futile conversation at her above the din.
"I like the hat," he bawled.
"What?"
"I said, I like the hat. I'm not wearing a hat."
"Well, I like the head then."
"What?"
"I said, I like the head. Interesting bone structure."
"What?"
Ford worked a shrug into the complex routine of other movements he was performing.
"I said you dance great," he shouted. "Just don't nod so much."
"What?"
"It's just that every time you nod," said Ford. "Ow!"
he added as his partner nodded forward to say what, and once again pecked him sharply on the forehead with the sharp end of her swept forward skull.
"My planet was blown up one morning," said Arthur, who had found himself quite unexpectedly telling the little man his life story, or at least edited highlights of it.
"That's why I'm dressed like this, in my dressing gown. My planet was blown up with all my clothes in it, you see. I didn't realise I'd be coming to a party."
The man nodded enthusiastically.
"Later I was thrown off a spaceship, still in my dressing gown, rather than the spacesuit one would normally expect. Shortly after that, I discovered that my planet had originally been built for a bunch of mice. You can imagine how I felt about that. I was then shot at for a while and blown up. In fact, I've been blown up ridiculously often, shot at, insulted, regularly disintegrated, deprived of tea, and recently I crashed into a swamp and had to spend 5 years in a damp cave."
"Ah," effervesced the little man, "and did you have a wonderful time?"
Arthur started to choke violently on his drink.
"What a wonderfully exciting cough," said the little man, quite startled by it. "Do you mind if I join in?"
and with that he launched into the most extraordinary and spectacular fit of coughing that caught Arthur so much by surprise that he started to choke violently, discovered that he was already doing it, and got thoroughly confused. Together they performed a lung-busting duet that went on for fully 2 minutes before Arthur managed to cough and splutter to a halt. "So invigorating," said the little man, panting and wiping tears from his eyes. "What an exciting life you must lead. Thank you very much." He shook Arthur warmly by the hand and walked off into the crowd. Arthur shook his head in astonishment. A youngish-looking man came up to him, an aggressive-looking type with a hook mouth, a lantern nose, and small beady little cheekbones. He was wearing black trousers, a black silk shirt open to what was presumably his navel, though Arthur had learnt never to make assumptions about the anatomies of the sort of people he tended to meet these days, and had all sorts of nasty dangly gold things hanging round his neck. He carried something in a black bag, and clearly wanted people to notice that he didn't want them to notice it. Hey, did I hear you say your name just now? He said. This is one of the many things that Arthur had told the enthusiastic little man. Yes, it's Arthur Dent. The man seemed to be dancing slightly to some rhythm other than any of the several that the band was grimly pushing out. Yeah, he said, only there was a man in a mountain who wanted to see you. I met him. Yeah, only he seemed pretty anxious about it, you know? Yes, I met him. Yeah, well, I think you should know that. I do, I met him. The man paused to chew a little gum. Then he clapped Arthur on the back. Okay, he said, all right, I'm just telling you, right? Good night, good luck, win awards. What? Said Arthur, who was beginning to flounder seriously at this point. Whatever, do what you do, do it well. He made a sort of clucking noise with whatever he was chewing and then some vaguely dynamic gesture. Why? Said Arthur. Do it badly, said the man. Who cares? Who gives a shit? The blood suddenly seemed to pump angrily into the man's face and he started to shout. Why not go mad? He said. Go away, get off my back, will you, guy? Just zark off. Okay, I'm going, said Arthur hurriedly. It's been real. The man gave a sharp wave and disappeared off into the throng. What was that about? Said Arthur to a girl he found standing beside him. Why did he tell me to win awards? Just showbiz talk, shrugged the girl. He's just won an award at the annual Ursa Minor Alpha Recreational Illusions Institute award ceremony, and he was hoping to be able to pass it off lightly, and you didn't mention it, so he couldn't. Oh, said Arthur. Oh, well, I'm sorry I didn't. What was it for? The most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay. It's very prestigious. I see, said Arthur. Yes, and what do you get for that? A Rory. It's just a small silver thing set on a large black base. What did you say? I didn't say anything. I was just about to ask what the silver... Oh, I thought you said whoop. Said what? Whoop. People had been dropping in on the party now for some years, fashionable gatecrashers from other worlds, and for some time it had occurred to the partygoers as they had looked out at their own world beneath them, with its wrecked cities, its ravaged avocado farms and blighted vineyards, its vast tracts of new desert, its seas full of cracker crumbs and worse, that their world was in some tiny and almost imperceptible ways not quite as much fun as it had been. Some of them began to wonder if they could manage to stay sober for long enough to make the entire party spaceworthy and maybe take it off to some other people's worlds where the air might be fresher and give them fewer headaches. The few undernourished farmers who still managed to scratch out a feeble existence on the half-dead ground of the planet's surface would have been extremely pleased to hear this. But that day, as the party came screaming out of the clouds and the farmers looked up in haggard fear of yet another cheese and wine raid, it became clear that the party was not going anywhere else for a while, that the party would soon be over. Very soon it would be time to gather up hats and coats and stagger blearily outside to find out what time of day it was, what time of year it was, and whether in any of this burnt and ravaged land there was a taxi going anywhere. The party was locked in a horrible embrace with a strange white spaceship that seemed to be half sticking through it. Together they were lurching, heaving and spinning their way around the sky in grotesque disregard of their own weight. The clouds parted, the air roared and leapt out of their way. The party and the cricket warship looked, in their writhings, a little like two ducks, one of which is trying to make a third duck inside the second duck, while the second duck is trying very hard to explain that it doesn't feel ready for a third duck right now, is uncertain that it would want any putative third duck to be made by this particular first duck anyway, and certainly not while it, the second duck, was busy flying. The sky sang and screamed with the rage of it all, and buffeted the ground with shock waves. And suddenly, with a foop, the cricket ship was gone. The party blundered helplessly across the sky, like a man leaning against an unexpectedly open door. It spun and wobbled on its hover jets. It tried to right itself and wronged itself instead. It staggered back across the sky again. For a while these staggerings continued, but clearly they could not continue for long. The party was now a mortally wounded party. All the fun had gone out of it, as the occasional broken-backed pirouette could not disguise. The longer at this point that it avoided the ground, the heavier was going to be the crash when finally it hit it. Inside, things were not going well either. They were going monstrously badly, in fact, and people were hating it and saying so loudly. The cricket robots had been. They had removed the award for the most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay, and in its place had left a scene of devastation that left Arthur feeling almost as sick as a runner-up for a Rory. "We would love to stay and help," shouted Ford, picking his way over the mangled debris, "only we're not going to." The party lurched again, provoking feverish cries and groans from amongst the smoking wreckage. "We have to go and save the universe, you see," said Ford, "and if that sounds like a pretty lame excuse, then you may be right. Either way, we're off." He suddenly came across an unopened bottle lying miraculously unbroken on the ground. "Do you mind if we take this?" he said. "You won't be needing it." He took a packet of potato crisps as well. "Trillion?" shouted Arthur in a shocked and weakened voice. In the smoking mess he could see nothing. "Earthman, we must go," said Slutty Bartfast nervously. "Trillion!" shouted Arthur again. A moment or two later, Trillion staggered, shaking, into view, supported by her new friend, the Thunder God. "The girl stays with me," said Thor. "There's a great party going on in Valhalla. We'll be flying off." "Where were you when all this is going on?" said Arthur. "Upstairs," said Thor. "I was weighing her. Flying's a tricky business, you see. We have to calculate wind." "She comes with us," said Arthur. "Hey," said Trillion, "don't I?" "No," said Arthur, "you come with us." Thor looked at him with slowly smouldering eyes. He was making some point about godliness, and it had nothing to do with being clean. "She comes with me," he said quietly. "Come on, Earthman," said Slutty Bartfast nervously, picking at Arthur's sleeve. "Come on, Slutty Bartfast," said Ford nervously, picking at the old man's sleeve. Slutty Bartfast had the teleport device. The party lurched and swayed, sending everyone reeling, except for Thor and except for Arthur, who stared, shaking, into the Thunder God's black eyes. Slowly, incredibly, Arthur put up what now appeared to be his tiny little fists. "Want to make something of it?" he said. "I beg your minuscule pardon," roared Thor. "I said," repeated Arthur, and he could not keep the quavering out of his voice, "do you want to make something of it?" He waggled his fists ridiculously. Thor looked at him with incredulity. Then a little wisp of smoke curled upward from his nostrils. There was a tiny little flame in it, too. He gripped his belt. He expanded his chest to make it totally clear that here was the sort of man you only dared to cross if you had a team of Sherpas with you. He unhooked the shaft of his hammer from his belt. He held it up in his hands to reveal the massive iron head. He thus cleared up any possible misunderstanding that he might merely have been carrying a telegraph pole around with him. "Do I want," he said with a hiss like a river flowing through a steel mill, "to make something of it?" "Yes," said Arthur, his voice suddenly and extraordinarily strong and belligerent. He waggled his fists again, this time as if he meant it. "You want to step outside?" he snarled at Thor. "All right," bellowed Thor like an enraged bull, or in fact like an enraged thunder god, which is a great deal more impressive, and did so. "Good," said Arthur. "That's got rid of him. Slutty, get us out of here." Chapter 23. "All right," shouted Ford and Arthur. "So I'm a coward. The point is, I'm still alive." They were back aboard the starship Bistromath. So was Slutty Bartfast. So was Trillion. Harmony and Concord were not. "Well, so I'm alive, aren't I?" retaliated Arthur, haggard with adventure and anger. His eyebrows were leaping up and down as if they wanted to punch each other. "You damn nearly weren't," exploded Ford. Arthur turned sharply to Slutty Bartfast, who was sitting in his pilot couch on the flight deck, gazing thoughtfully into the bottom of a bottle that was telling him something he clearly couldn't fathom. He appealed to him. "Do you think he understands the first word I've been saying?" he said, quivering with emotion. "I don't know," replied Slutty Bartfast a little abstractedly. "I'm not sure," he added, glancing up very briefly, "that I do." He stared at his instruments with renewed vigour and bafflement. "You'll have to explain it to us again," he said. "Well, but later terrible things are afoot." He tapped the pseudo-glass of the bottle bottom.
"We fared rather pathetically at the party, I'm afraid," he said, "and our only hope now is to try and prevent the robots from using the key in the lock. How in heaven we do that, I don't know," he muttered. "Just have to go there, I suppose. Can't say I like the idea at all. Probably end up dead."
Where is Trillian, anyway?" said Arthur with a sudden affectation of unconcern. What he had been angry about was that Fort had berated him for wasting time over all the business of the Thunder God when they could have been making a rather more rapid escape. Arthur's own opinion, and he had offered it for whatever anybody might have felt it was worth, was that he had been extraordinarily brave and resourceful. The prevailing view seemed to be that his opinion was not worth a pair of fetid dingo's kidneys. What really hurt, though, was that Trillian didn't seem to react much one way or the other, and had wandered off somewhere.
"And where are my potato crisps?" said Ford.
"They are both," said Slarty Bartfast, without looking up, "in the room of informational illusions. I think that your young lady friend is trying to understand some problems of galactic history. I think the potato crisps are probably helping her."
Chapter 24. It is a mistake to think you can solve any major problems just with potatoes. For instance, there was once an insanely aggressive race of people called the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stryterax. That was just the name of their race. The name of their army was something quite horrific. Luckily, they lived even farther back in galactic history than anything we have so far encountered, 20 billion years ago, when the galaxy was young and fresh and every idea worth fighting for was a new one. And fighting was what the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stryterax were good at, and being good at it, they did it a lot. They fought their enemies, i.e. everybody else, they fought each other. Their planet was a complete wreck. The surface was littered with abandoned cities that were surrounded by abandoned war machines, which were in turn surrounded by deep bunkers in which the Silastic Armor Fiends lived and squabbled with each other. The best way to pick a fight with the Silastic Armor Fiend of Stryterax was just to be born. They didn't like it, they got resentful. And when an armor fiend got resentful, someone got hurt. An exhausting way of life, one might think, but they did seem to have an awful lot of energy. The best way of dealing with the Silastic Armor Fiend was to put him in a room on his own, because sooner or later he would simply beat himself up. Eventually they realized that this is something they were going to have to sort out, and they passed a law decreeing that anyone who had to carry a weapon as part of his normal Silastic work, policemen, security guards, primary school teachers, etc., had to spend at least 45 minutes every day punching a sack of potatoes in order to work off his or her surplus aggression. For a while this worked well, until someone thought it would be much more efficient and less time-consuming if they simply shot the potatoes instead. This led to a renewed enthusiasm for shooting all sorts of things, and they all got very excited at the prospect of their first major war for weeks. Another achievement of the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stryterax is that they were the first race who ever managed to shock a computer. It was a gigantic spaceborne computer called Haktar, which to this day is remembered as one of the most powerful ever built. It was the first to be built like a natural brain, in that every cellular particle of it carried the pattern of the whole within it, which enabled it to think more flexibly and imaginatively, and also, it seemed, to be shocked. The Silastic Armor Fiends of Stryterax were engaged in one of their regular wars with the strenuous Garfighters of Stug, and were not enjoying it as much as usual, because it involved an awful lot of trekking through the radiation swamps of Qualzenda and across the fire mountains of Frasfraga, neither of which terrains they felt at home in. So when the Strangulus Stiletans of Jajazikstak joined in the fray and forced them to fight another front in the Gamma Caves of Carfrax and the ice storms of Valanguten, they decided that enough was enough, and they ordered Haktar to design for them an ultimate weapon.
"What do you mean?" asked Haktar, "by ultimate?" To which the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stryterax said, "Read a bloody dictionary," and plunged back into the fray. So Haktar designed an ultimate weapon. It was a very, very small bomb that was simply a junction box in hyperspace which would, when activated, connect the heart of every major sun with the heart of every other major sun simultaneously, and thus turn the entire universe into one gigantic hyperspatial supernova. When the Silastic Armor Fiends tried to use it to blow up a Strangulus Stiletan munitions dump in one of the Gamma Caves, they were extremely irritated that it didn't work, and said so. Haktar had been shocked by the whole idea. He tried to explain that he'd been thinking about this ultimate weapon business and had worked out that there was no conceivable consequence of not setting the bomb off that was worse than the known consequence of setting it off, and he had therefore taken the liberty of introducing a small flaw into the design of the bomb, and he hoped that everyone involved would, on sober reflection, feel that the Silastic armor fiends disagreed and pulverized the computer. Later, they thought better of it and destroyed the faulty bomb as well. Then, pausing only to smash the hell out of the strenuous garfighters of Stug and the strangulous stilettons of Jajazikstak, they then went on to find an entirely new way of blowing themselves up, which was a profound relief to everyone else in the galaxy, particularly the garfighters, the stilettons, and the potatoes. Trillian had watched all this, as well as the story of Cricket. She emerged from the room of informational illusions thoughtfully, just in time to discover that they had arrived too late. Chapter 25. Even as the starship Bistromath flickered into objective being on the top of a small cliff on the mile-wide asteroid that pursued a lonely and eternal path in orbit around the enclosed star system of Cricket, its crew was aware that they were in time only to be witnesses to an unstoppable historic event. They didn't realize they were going to see two. They stood, cold, lonely, and helpless on the cliff edge, and watched the activity below. Lances of light wheeled in sinister arcs against the void from a point only about 100 yards below and in front of them. They stared into the blinding event. An extension of the ship's field enabled them to stand there by once again exploiting the mind's predisposition to have tricks played on it. The problems of falling up off the tiny mass of the asteroid or of not being able to breathe simply became somebody else's. The white Cricket warship was parked among the stark grey crags of the asteroid, alternately flaring under arc lights or disappearing in shadow. The black shadows cast by the hard rocks danced together in wild choreography as the arc lights swept around them. The 11 white robots were bearing in procession the wicket key out into the middle of a circle of swinging lights. The wicket key had been rebuilt. Its components shone and glittered. The steel pillar, or Marvin's leg, of strength and power, the golden bale, or heart of the infinite improbability drive, of prosperity, the perspex pillar, or Argobuthon scepter of justice, of science and reason, the silver bale, or Rory Award for the most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay, and the now reconstituted wooden pillar, or ashes of a burnt stump signifying the death of English cricket, of nature and spirituality. "I suppose there is nothing we can do at this point?" asked Arthur nervously. "No," sighed Slarty Bartfast. The expression of disappointment that crossed Arthur's face was a complete failure, and since he was standing obscured by shadow, he allowed it to collapse into one of relief. Pity, he said. "We have no weapons," said Slotty Bartfast, stupidly. Damn, said Arthur very quietly. Ford said nothing. Trillian said nothing, but in a peculiarly thoughtful and distinct way. She was staring at that blankness of the space beyond the asteroid. The asteroid circled the dust cloud that surrounded the slow time envelope that enclosed the world on which lived the people of Cricket, the masters of Cricket and their killer robots. The helpless group had no way of knowing whether or not the Cricket robots were aware of their presence. They could only assume that they must be, but they felt, quite rightly in the circumstances, that they had nothing to fear. They had an historic task to perform, and their audience could be regarded with contempt. "Terribly impotent feeling, isn't it?" said Arthur, but the others ignored him. In the centre of the area of light that the robots were approaching, a square-shaped crack appeared in the ground. The crack defined itself more and more distinctly, and soon it became clear that a block of the ground, about 6 feet square, was slowly rising. At the same time, they became aware of some other movement, but it was also subliminal, and for a moment or two it was not clear what it was that was moving. Then it became clear. The asteroid was moving.
It was moving in toward the dust cloud, as if being hauled inexorably by some celestial angler in its depths. They were to make in real life the journey through the cloud that they had already made in the room of informational illusions. They stood frozen in silence. Trillian frowned. An age seemed to pass. Events seemed to pass with spinning slowness as the leading edge of the asteroid passed into the vague and soft outer perimeter of the cloud. And soon they were engulfed in the thin and dancing obscurity. They passed on through it, on and on, dimly aware of vague shapes and walls, indistinguishable in the darkness except in the corner of the eye. The dust dimmed the shafts of brilliant light. The shafts of brilliant light twinkled on the myriad specks of dust. Trillian again regarded the passage from within her own frowning thoughts. And they were through it. Whether it had taken a minute or half an hour, they weren't sure, but they were through it and confronted with a fresh blankness, as if space were pinched out of existence in front of them. And now things moved quickly. A blinding shaft of light seemed almost to explode from out of the block that had risen 3 feet out of the ground, and out of that rose a smaller perspex block, dazzling with interior dancing colours. The block was slotted with deep grooves, 3 upright and 2 across, clearly designed to accept the wicket key. The robots approached the lock, slotted the key into its home, and stepped back again. The block twisted around of its own accord, and space began to alter. As space unpinched itself, it seemed agonizingly to twist the eyes of the watchers in their sockets. They found themselves staring, blinded, at an unraveled sun that stood now before them, where it seemed only seconds before there had not been even empty space. It was a second or two before they were even sufficiently aware of what had happened to throw their hands up over their horrified, blinded eyes. In that second or two, they were aware of a tiny speck moving slowly across the eye of that sun. They staggered back and heard ringing in their ears the thin and unexpected chant of the robots crying out in unison, "Cricket! Cricket! Cricket! Cricket!" The sound chilled them. It was harsh, it was cold, it was empty, it was mechanically dismal. It was also triumphant. They were so stunned by these 2 sensory shocks that they almost missed the second historic event. Zaphod Beeblebrox, the only man in history to survive a direct blast attack from the cricket robots, ran out of the cricket warship, brandishing a zap gun. "Okay," he cried, "the situation is totally under control as of this moment in time." The single robot guarding the hatchway to the ship silently swung his battle club and connected it with the back of Zaphod's left head. "Who the zark did that?" said his left head and lolled sickeningly forward. His right head gazed keenly into the middle distance. "Who did what?" it said. The club connected with the back of his right head. Zaphod measured his length and rather strange shape on the ground. Within a matter of seconds, the whole event was over. A few blasts from the robot were sufficient to destroy the lock forever. It split and melted and splayed its contents brokenly, and the robots marched grimly and, it almost seemed, in a slightly disheartened manner, back into their warship, which, with a foop, was gone. Trillian and Ford ran hectically around and down the steep incline to the dark, still body of Zaphod Beeblebrox. Chapter 26. "I don't know," said Zaphod, for what seemed to him like the 37th time. "They could have killed me, but they didn't. Maybe they just thought I was a kind of wonderful guy or something. I could understand that." The others silently registered their opinions of this theory. Zaphod lay on the cold floor of the flight deck. His back seemed to wrestle the floor as pain thudded through him and banged at his heads. "I think," he whispered, "that there's something wrong with those anodized dudes, something fundamentally weird."
"They are programmed to kill everybody," Slotty Bartfass pointed out.
"That," wheezed Zaphod between the whacking thuds, "could be it."
He didn't seem altogether convinced.
"Hey, baby," he said to Trillian, hoping this would make up for his previous behavior.
"You all right?" she said gently.
Yeah, he said, I'm fine.
Good, she said, and walked away to think. She stared at the huge Visi screen over the flight couches, and twisting a switch, she flipped local images over it. One image was the blankness of the dust cloud, one was the sun of cricket, one was cricket itself. She flipped between them fiercely.
Well, that's goodbye galaxy, then, said Arthur, slapping his knees and standing up.
No, said Slarty Bartfast gravely, our course is clear. He furrowed his brow until you could grow some of the smaller root vegetables in it. He stood up, he paced around. When he spoke again, what he said frightened him so much he had to sit down again.
We must go down to cricket, he said. A deep sigh shook his old frame, and his eyes seemed almost to rattle in their sockets.
Once again, he said, we have failed pathetically, quite pathetically.
That, said Ford quietly, is because we don't care enough, I told you.
He swung his feet up onto the instrument panel and picked fitfully at something on one of his fingernails.
But unless we determine to take action, said the old man querulously, as if struggling against something deeply insouciant in his nature, then we shall all be destroyed. We shall all die. Surely we care about that.
Yeah, not enough to want to get killed over it, said Ford. He put on a sort of hollow smile and flipped it around the room at anyone who wanted to see it.
Slarty Bartfast clearly found this point of view extremely seductive, and he fought against it. He turned again to Zaphod, who was gritting his teeth and sweating with the pain.
You surely must have some idea, he said, of why they spared your life. It seems most strange and unusual.
I kind of think they didn't know, shrugged Zaphod. I told you, they hit me with the most feeble blast, just knocked me out, right? They lugged me under their ship, dumped me in a corner and ignored me, like they were embarrassed about me being there. If I said anything, they knocked me out again. We had some great conversations. Hey, hi there, I wonder, kept me amused for hours, you know.
He winced again. He was toying with something in his fingers. He held it up. It was the golden bale. The heart of gold, the heart of the infinite improbability drive. Only that and the wooden pillar had survived the destruction of the lock intact.
I hear your ship can move a bit, he said, so how'd you like to zip me back to mine before you...
Will you not help us? Said Slarty Bartfast.
Us, said Ford sharply. Who's us? I'd love to stay and help you save the galaxy, insisted Zaphod, raising himself up onto his shoulders. But I have the mother and father of a pair of headaches, and I feel a lot of little headaches coming on. But next time I need saving, I'm your guy. Hey, Trillion Baby!
She looked around briefly. Yes?
You want to come, Heart of Gold? Excitement and adventure and really wild things?
I'm going down to cricket, she said. Chapter 27 It was the same hill, and yet not the same. This time it was not an informational illusion. This was cricket itself, and they were standing on it. Near them, behind the trees, stood the strange Italian restaurant that had brought these, their real bodies, to this, the real, present world of cricket. The strong grass under their feet was real, the rich soil real, too. The heady fragrances from the tree, too, were real. The night was real night. Cricket. Possibly the most dangerous place in the galaxy for anyone who isn't a cricketer to stand. The place that could not countenance the existence of any other place, whose charming, delightful, intelligent inhabitants would howl with fear, savagery, and murderous hate when confronted with anyone not their own. Arthur shuddered. Slarty Bartfast shuddered. Ford, surprisingly, shuddered. It was not surprising that he shuddered, it was surprising that he was there at all. But when they had returned Zaphod to his ship, Ford had felt unexpectedly shamed into not running away.
Wrong, he thought to himself, wrong, wrong, wrong.
He hugged to himself one of the zap guns with which they had armed themselves out of Zaphod's armory. Trillian shuddered and frowned as she looked into the sky. This, too, was not the same. It was no longer blank and empty. While the countryside around them had changed little in the 2,000 years of the cricket wars, and the mere 5 years that had elapsed locally since cricket was sealed in its slow time envelope 10 billion years ago, the sky was dramatically different. Dim lights and heavy shapes hung in it. High in the sky, where no cricketer ever looked, were the war zones, the robot zones, huge warships and tower blocks floating in the nilograv fields far above the idyllic pastoral lands of the surface of cricket. Trillian stared at them and thought.
Trillian, whispered Ford Prefect to her.
Yes, she said.
What are you doing?
Thinking. Do you always breathe like that when you're thinking?
I wasn't aware that I was breathing.
That's what worried me.
I think I know, said Trillian.
Shh, said Slarty Bartfast in alarm, and his thin, trembling hand motioned them farther back beneath the shadow of the tree. Suddenly, as before in the tape, there were lights coming along the hill path. But this time the dancing beams were not from lanterns, but flashlights, not in itself a dramatic change, but every detail made their hearts thump with fear. This time there were no lilting, whimsical songs about flowers and farming and dead dogs, but hushed voices in urgent debate. A light moved in the sky with slow weight. Arthur was clenched with a claustrophobic terror, and the warm wind caught at his throat. Within seconds, a second party became visible, approaching from the other side of the dark hill. They were moving swiftly and purposefully, their flashlights swinging and probing around them. The parties were clearly converging, and not merely with each other. They were converging deliberately on the spot where Arthur and the others were standing. Arthur heard the slight rustle as Ford Prefect raised his zap gun to his shoulder, and the slight whimpering cough as Slarty Bartfast raised his. He felt the cold, unfamiliar weight of his own gun, and with shaking hands, he raised it. His fingers fumbled to release the safety catch and engage the extreme danger catch, as Ford had shown him. He was shaking so much that if he'd fired at anybody at that moment, he probably would have burnt his signature on them. Only Trillian didn't raise her gun. She raised her eyebrows, lowered them again, and bit her lip in thought. "Has it occurred to you," she began, but nobody wanted to discuss anything much at the moment. A light stabbed through the darkness from behind them, and they spun round to find a third party of cricketers behind them, searching them out with their flashlights. Ford Prefect's gun crackled viciously, but fire spat back at it and it crashed from his hands. There was a moment of pure fear, a frozen second before anyone fired again, and at the end of the second, nobody fired. They were surrounded by pale-faced cricketers and bathed in bobbing torchlight. The captives stared at their captors. The captors stared at their captives. "Hello," said one of the captors. "Excuse me, but are you aliens?" Chapter 28. Meanwhile, more millions of miles away than the mind can comfortably encompass, Zaphod Beeblebrox was feeling bored. He'd repaired his ship, that is, he'd watched with alert interest while a service robot had repaired it for him. It was now, once again, one of the most powerful and extraordinary ships in existence. He could go anywhere, do anything. He fiddled with the book and then tossed it away. It was the one he'd read before. He walked over to the communications bank and opened an all-frequencies emergency channel. "Anyone want a drink?" he asked. "This an emergency, fella?" crackled a voice from halfway across the galaxy. "Got any mixers?" said Zaphod. "Go take a ride on a comet." Okay, said Zaphod and flipped the channel shut again. He sighed and sat down. He got up again and wandered over to a computer screen. He pushed a few buttons. Little blobs started to rush around the screen, eating each other. "Pow," said Zaphod. "For you! Pop, pop, pop!" "Hi there," said the computer briefly after a minute of this. "You have scored 3 points. Previous best score, 7,797,200. Okay, said Zaphod, and flipped the screen blank again. He sat down again. He played with the pencil. This, too, began slowly to lose its fascination. Okay, he said, and fed his score and the previous best one into the computer. His ship made a blur of the universe.
End of side 4.